still jacking it.
Don't tell Mother I was pleasuring myself to the cattle!
Rourke had clearly not taken many ranks in diplomacy. Who the fuck are you calling cattle, runt? Stacy's glare lessened in intensity as she turned to Julian. Oh yeah, that reminds me. We're in cages because this is a village of cannibals.
What?
Julian thought back to the night before.
So last night, that meat we were eating, was it?
You were probably eating goat,
said the dwarf girl, as she groped in the webs through the bars of her cell.
They don't get enough visitors to feed their demand, and they don't see us real people.
She caught a hold of part of Rourke, as evidenced by his yelp, then slammed it repeatedly on the hard stone floor until he stopped making noise and the webs near where Julian guessed his crotch was stopped moving. She then reached down that way and picked up talking where she'd left off.
You're lower than a dwarf in their eyes, but higher than what they refer to as the baser animals. In other words, you're quality meat, fit for a dwarf.
Rourke appeared, unconscious or dead, with his head bleeding on the floor and his dick in his hand. Julian was impressed with his dedication to complete the task. The dwarf girl was holding his ring. Stacy's eyes went wide. She frantically patted her pockets, then hung her head and kicked the cell bars. She didn't need to say it. They'd taken the die.
I'm sorry, said Julian to the dwarf girl. We haven't been properly introduced. I'm Julian, and this is Stacy. And you are?
My name is Magra. I wandered away from my tribe, got lost in the mountains, then stumbled into this village. Do you have any food?
Sorry, said Stacy. We didn't have time to prepare before we started traveling. They don't feed you in here?
They've offered me human, halfling, and half-elf. They say it's a rite of passage, so I may be deemed fit to be a member of the village. I've refused so far. If I hold out for one more week, they say they'll feed me to old Edna. I guess she's their leader or something.
Actually, she's a dire crocodile they keep in a moat on the southern border of the village, said Julian. Could we maybe talk about all this later? We've got one of theirs lying here, perhaps dead, with his dick in his hand. If we don't figure out a way to get out of here, we'll all be fed to old Edna.
I've got an idea, said Stacy. Magra, put on that ring.
Julian felt a reminder was in order.
That's my ring?
Shut up, Julian.
I want it back later.
Magra slipped on the ring and disappeared. A second later, something clunked against the bars of her cell. Stacy rolled her eyes.
It makes you invisible, dear, not incorporeal.
Then what good is it?
Said Magra.
Next time someone comes in here, we'll say that Rourke was pleasuring himself to you, and you just went totally apeshit on him.
Totally apeshit?
That's right. Then you grabbed something from his pocket and used it to pick the lock and escaped. When they opened the cell door, you jumped them for real.
Julian nodded.
Impressive. We're literally spelling out exactly how we're going to escape in order to trick them into helping us do it.
There's just one problem, said Magra.
Julian and Stacy looked at her, or at least in her general direction.
What's that? Asked Stacy. Why are they going to open the cell door?
Julian frowned. That was a good point.
Rifle through his pockets, said Stacy. Maybe you can find something that will look like a clue they'd want to investigate, or...
A door creaked from above, letting some natural light in from the stairwell outside the kennels. Julian turned to Stacy. She shrugged.
Just go with the plan we've got.
What's this? Why is it so bright down here?
It was Orgel's voice. The door above closed, blocking out the early morning light in the stairwell. Julian thought it might have been a good idea to cover his enchanted chip of stone, but it was too late now. He heard Orgel's heavy, erratic footsteps on the stairs, but only saw a strange shimmer when Orgel should have been emerging into the room.
Mercy of the gods!
The barely visible shimmering figure swatted at the decaying strands of webbing between the cells.
What is all of this, Rourke?
It was diplomacy time. Julian cleared his throat.
Sir, we're very sorry for your...
Shut up, elf!
Shouted Orgel, becoming partly visible as he lowered the hood of Stacy's cloak of elven kind.
What's happened here?
That was unnecessarily confusing. Was Julian supposed to shut up or answer the question?
I'll tell you what happened, Stacy snapped at him. He came down here and pulled his little dwarf sausage out at the young woman you had locked in there. Then she beat the shit out of him, grabbed his keys, and let herself out.
Shut your lying whore mouth, human! Rourke doesn't have the keys!
He pulled a key ring off his belt to show her.
Only I...
His hand punched between the cell bars like it had a mind of its own. and the rest of him followed. Magra was flickering back into visibility, both of her hands gripped firmly on Orgel's wrist. She could have gone for the keys, but she clearly wanted more than just to escape. When Orgel's face slammed into the bars, she bit down hard on his forearm. Orgel screamed as his blood first trickled, then flowed down Magra's chin and puddled on the floor. The keys dropped by her feet, but she only bit down more ferociously. Finally, she tore away a horrifically large chunk of skin and muscle, then spat out what wasn't still dangling from his arm.
"There, I've tried it," she said, her mouth dripping with blood.
She spat out as much as she could.
"I'm afraid it's still not to my liking,"
Orgel moaned, dropped to his knees, and pissed himself. Stacy sighed.
"I wouldn't mind if at least some of my cloak wasn't soaked with liquid Orgel."
Julian had what he deemed more pressing concerns.
"If he keeps moaning like that, someone might hear him."
Despite her current physical state, Magra pushed and pulled Orgel's arm, repeatedly slamming his head into the bars until he stopped moaning, or moving, or probably breathing. Julian couldn't blame her. He had no idea how he'd handle prolonged starvation, and hoped he'd never have to find out. But damn, she was intense. When she was satisfied that Orgel's voluntary noises would be quieter than the noise of his head repeatedly banging against the steel bars of her cell, or perhaps when it just ceased being enjoyable for her, Magra let him collapse onto the floor. She picked up the keyring and unlocked her cell door. Then she gave Julian a good hard look in the eye. It was unsettling, not only because her face was still dripping with fresh murder blood, but also because Julian, until now, had taken for granted that she was going to spring them from their cell as well.
"I need to keep this ring," she said.
"Fucking A,"
Julian blurted out. It's not what he normally would have went with, but he was so overwhelmed with relief about her stipulation that it just came out.
"I mean, of course. I wouldn't dream of taking it back from you after what you've been through."
She spent a second, which felt like a month, thinking it over further, then tossed the keyring to him. Julian gratefully unlocked the door to their cell and pocketed the keys. It wasn't much, but any effort he could put forth to make it more difficult to lock people in cages to be eaten was worth putting forth. Careful to step around the blood and pee, Stacy relieved Orgel of her cloak of elvenkind, then patted him down.
"Fuck," she said. "The dye isn't on him."
"It must be back at the house."
Julian turned to Magra, who had apparently turned invisible again.
"Magra, would it be okay if we borrowed that ring just one more time before..."
The door at the top of the stairs creaked open.
"Shit," whispered Stacy. "Somebody else is coming. Oh, what do we do?"
Julian looked around frantically, trying to think of a plan in the 5 seconds it would take for someone to descend the stairs.
"You and I hide on either side of the doorway. Magra can just hang out here. As long as they step through, we all jump them."
Stacy nodded.
"Good plan."
Magra made no indication that she understood the plan, but as plans go, it was a pretty simple one, and Julian was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. Julian and Stacy waited in their positions for 5 seconds, then 10, then 15. Around 20 seconds in, Julian found it odd that he couldn't even hear footsteps.
"Magra?"
said Stacy, not bothering to keep her voice down. Julian glared at her and pressed his finger against his lips.
"She's not here. The door opening wasn't someone coming in. It was Magra leaving. She ditched us."
"Ah, well."
Julian had made peace with losing his ring. With all Magra had been through, he would have let her keep it, even if she wasn't holding the threat of letting a bunch of dwarves eat him over his head.
"Good for her. I hope she finds her fam."
A faint scream came from outside, then cut off.
"Did you hear that?"
asked Julian. Stacy nodded.
"Sounds like Grella."
She pulled up her hood and turned almost invisible, then blurred past Julian and through the doorway. Julian followed her up the stairs, wishing he wasn't the only clearly visible escaped convict running around this village. But it was still early, and he couldn't think of much to do in a village of cannibalistic dwarves that would necessitate getting out of bed before the sun had properly risen. Fortunately, it was only a short sprint across the grass from the root cellar prison to the house, and he didn't see anyone wandering around outside. The back door was open, and Julian walked in on a grisly scene in the kitchen. Grella lay dead on the floor, with a hatchet still lodged in her skull and a still-expanding pool of blood spilling under it. Stacy pulled down her hood and became visible.
"Did you?"
Julian dared not finish. Stacy shook her head and pointed to sticky red footprints leading toward the open front door. Looks like Magra had one last errand to run before she got the hell out of Dodge.
Mama?
Called one of the younger dwarflings from the other room.
I had a bad dream. I heard someone screaming.
You take care of this, said Stacy. I'll look for the dye.
What? How do I? Shit!
Julian jumped into the doorway just in time to block the tiny dwarf girl from entering the kitchen. He smiled down at her nervously.
Hello?
You're not Mama.
That's true.
Come on, Diplomacy. You can do better than that.
Where's Mama?
She's,
Shit,
said Stacy from another room. Julian sighed.
That's right. Mama's taking a shit. Now run along back to bed.
The little girl frowned.
But I'm thirsty.
Stay right here.
Julian glanced back behind them. The pitcher of sweet milk was still on the table, along with a nearly empty bottle of that NyQuil-like liquor they'd used to knock out him and Stacy. He grabbed the one bowl remaining on the table, presumably the one Orgel had been drinking from, as it still had some residual brown liquid in it. Hopefully, it would be enough to put this kid down until noon. After filling the bowl with sweet milk, he handed it down to the little girl. She gulped it back, then returned it to him.
Okay, said Julian. I'm back to bed now.
But I need to tinkle.
I told you, Mama's in there right now. She could be a while. Can't you hold it until you wake up later?
The girl crossed her legs and squirmed.
No.
Whoa, kid, keep your voice down. You don't want to wake everyone up.
Julian thought for a moment, then realized the answer was right there in his hand. He gulped back the pint's worth of sweet milk that was left in the pitcher, then handed it down to her.
Here, tinkle in this.
She took the pitcher with both hands, looked doubtfully into it, then decided it would have to do and retreated back to her room. Julian sighed.
I found it,
said Stacy, right behind him, nearly causing him to have a mid-sigh heart attack.
Ready to go?
What about this?
Julian gestured at the dead body on the floor. Stacy looked down.
A good idea.
She grabbed the hatchet by the handle and yanked it out of Grella's head.
Can't hurt to have one more weapon. At least you know it works, right?
Jesus, Stacy. I mean, what about the body on the floor? And all of this blood? What's going to happen when the kids wake up and see their dead mother?
I don't know. Maybe they'll grow up to be murderers or cannibals or something. Oh, wait, I forgot. They were already headed down that road anyway.
Come on, we can't just...
There's a lot we can't do, Julian. We can't bring her back to life. We can't clean this mess up and bury the body before the village wakes up. And we can't afford to waste any more time before they send a hunting party after us, who know their way around these mountains a hell of a lot better than we do. We need to get as long a head start as we can before...
Grella!
Said an older woman's voice from outside.
I brought you some of those fried human finger fillets. You're always going up.
The kindly neighbor stopped in the doorway and dropped her tray of fried human finger snacks. She looked up from Grella's dead body to the bloody hatchet in Stacy's hand. Stacy quickly hid the hatchet behind her back.
This isn't what it looks like.
The old woman ran away, as much as an old dwarf woman can be said to run, screaming,
Help! Help! The beasts have mauled Grella!
Mauled? Said Stacy. Like I'm a bear or something? How racist do you have to be to not even credit me with murder?
Julian wished he'd prepared a sleep spell to buy them some more time, but he had to make do with what he had.
Horse!
After he and Stacy climbed on, he slapped the reins and guided the horse out of the village and into the Rocky Mountain wilderness beyond it. The rising sun was peeking up from between two peaks at his 2 o'clock. They were traveling east and slightly north, the route they'd take if they wanted to get back to Cardinia. He didn't know if that's what Stacy wanted to do, but they could discuss the matter once they weren't being hunted by a mob of angry dwarves.
Chapter 44. Catherine sat on Nightwind's rear deck, staring at the line she had in the water. It was more like rope than modern fishing line she was used to, easy to see even in the early morning darkness. Fish back in the day must have been dumb as shit. She didn't care if she caught anything or not. She was mainly interested in trying to estimate the ship's speed by seeing how quickly the line cut through the water. The sea was calm, and there was barely a breeze. It didn't feel like they were moving at all. At Randy's request, her former crewman had pointed her ship in the right direction and rigged the sails for her. They told her that if nobody touched anything, the ice sheet around Nazir should be wide enough for them to run into it. That was good enough for her.
She didn't hold any grudges for them not wanting to go on what they saw as a suicide mission. And why wouldn't they? They'd all grown up on these wild sailor tales. For Catherine's part, she was putting her faith in the propaganda theory that Randy had pulled out of his ass at a moment's notice. She took comfort in that he seemed to be genuinely unafraid of what may lie ahead for them all. If he was hiding his fear, he was doing a much better job of that than he was with hiding his sorrow at parting ways with Alexi, Captain Longfellow's first mate.
"Kinda chilly out here, ain't it?" said Randy.
"Speak of the devil." Catherine's grim reaper cloak and Captain Martinoli's brandy were keeping her warm enough, but she noticed that she could see her breath.
"It'll warm up once the sun comes up."
Randy took a seat on the other side of the rear deck.
"Catch anything?"
Catherine shook her head.
"I'm not even sure if there's still bait on the hook."
"Something on your mind?"
"I'm just thinking about Tim, about why I'm doing all this."
"Why?"
said Randy.
"It's because you love your brother, of course. He's lucky to have a sister like you."
Catherine shrugged.
"I guess that's part of it, but I think a bigger part is that it's something to do."
"You mean like Minesweeper?"
"Yeah, actually, kind of like that."
Catherine gulped back a swig of brandy from the bottle, then offered it to Randy, who declined.
"You know how, back in your normal life, you'd get up every day and go to a job, then you'd go wind down at a bar, or go home and watch TV? Maybe sometime along the line, you get married and have some kids, and eventually you die?"
"I suppose so."
Randy sounded doubtful.
"Well, maybe it's a little different for registered sex offenders. Maybe a beat off to Sesame Street, then microwave a burrito for breakfast or whatever."
Randy looked slightly annoyed.
"I don't know how many times I got to..."
"My point is, we had a routine. No matter how miserable we were about having to do it, we knew when we got up what we were going to do each day, right?"
"Sure."
"I don't have that here. I feel like if I didn't have this stupid quest to keep me occupied, I'd be going nuts. It's like the job, the kids, the bars... all of that shit is gone. I'm just waiting for the eventually you die part."
"Ain't a whole lot for me back home," said Randy.
"That's my point. I've got nothing going for me back home either. I'm the co-owner of a shitty fast food chicken restaurant with my brother. But at least I know what I'm supposed to do every day. Even if it's a lousy direction, it's a direction. Here, it's like I'm just adrift at sea."
Catherine took a moment to take in her surroundings.
"I'm literally adrift at sea. I'm living a goddamn metaphor."
"You'll find your way. Once we get Tim back, I reckon you'll still have plenty to do taking care of him. He seems to have taken a harder downward turn as of late, and he'll need your support to climb out of the hole he's dug for himself."
"Who the fuck am I to help anyone climb out of a hole? I'm down there in that hole with him."
"You don't give yourself enough credit," said Randy. "You're a talented and clever young lady. Look at how much you've accomplished in only the past couple of days. You need to get to an island, and the next thing you know, you're the captain of your own ship."
"Which I don't even know how to sail."
"You'll pick that up in time. What I'm saying is, you got a knack for getting shit done, girl."
Randy's words and smile felt sincere. They warmed her even more deeply than the cloak or brandy had managed to.
"That's really sweet of you, Randy," said Catherine.
She hadn't really noticed until now, but he really was a handsome guy, which was odd because he also looked pretty much the same as he had back in the real world. It was as though the game used some kind of Instagram giving a shit about yourself filter to show his greatest potential. She smiled back at him.
"It's too bad you're gay."
"Huh?
Oh, wow. That came out so wrong. I didn't mean to say it's bad that you're gay. It's good that you're gay. I love that you're gay."
"Stop saying you're gay."
"I just meant here we are in a boat. Sky full of stars, you're single, I'm single, you're good-looking, I'm
crunch."
"What?"
She was jolted off the back of the ship. Splash.
"Splash!"
She cried out in a burst of bubbles. The water was freezing. She willed herself to avoid going into shock. She didn't know how fast the boat was moving, and Randy couldn't swim. She had to get to the ladder before he ignored that fact and jumped in to rescue her. Having reoriented herself to the best of her ability, she started swimming hard in the direction she guessed the boat was. Two strokes in, she slammed her head straight into it. She used the last of her breath in another burst of bubbly swearing, then climbed up the ladder at the rear of the ship. Butterbean looked down at her and barked helplessly.
Are you okay?
Said Randy, getting to his feet as Catherine climbed back onto the deck. At least Butterbean was smart enough to know it would have only made the problem worse to jump in after her. It appeared the only thing that had stopped Randy from doing so was that he'd fallen backwards.
No, I'm not fucking okay. I'm freezing.
Her sopping wet clothes in the chill of the breeze felt colder than being in the water had.
I need to get out of these clothes.
She looked around for alternatives to being straight up naked. Her gaze fell on the bag of holding.
I need to go inside the bag and see if there's anything in there for me to wear. Give me a minute, then reach inside the bag and say, Catherine, can you do that?
Randy nodded confidently.
Sure I can.
If you fuck this up, I'm going to suffocate and die.
I got it, said Randy. I put my hand in the bag and say, Catherine, I seen y'all use the bag before.
It was a simple enough task, but Randy was nothing if not a simple man. Another breeze nudged her decision along.
Okay, here goes.
She pulled the bag down over her head and found herself floating in the all-too-familiar void. How many times had she vowed to herself that she'd never get in this bag again? Ah, well, at least it wasn't as cold in here as it was out.
What the fuck?
She'd expected to see giant rat corpses floating around. With her mind focused on being cold as fuck, that's the only thing she could remember being in the bag. But there was something wrong with the corpses. They all appeared mummified, their skin clinging tightly to the bones. Were they decomposing? Was her meat-preserving properties of a bag of holding theory debunked? Catherine hadn't seen a whole lot of decomposing bodies in her lifetime, but these didn't line up exactly with her mental image of what that was supposed to look like. There were no gaping holes full of squirming maggots, no discoloration, no foul odor, at least no more fouler than before. As one rat corpse floated by near enough for her to examine it, its skin didn't appear to be damaged at all. It was shriveled up like a...
Holy shit!
Having had an epiphany, Catherine hurriedly began taking off all of her wet clothes. With each garment she shed, she felt better and better, until she could finally laugh at how Randy was going to react when he... A hand grabbed her left tit and squeezed hard.
What the fuck?
She said, stark naked with the chill of the deck biting her ass and Randy's hand on her tit.
Shit!
Cried Randy, putting his hands up like a dozen state troopers had just drawn guns on him.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to... Hang on. Why ain't you got no clothes on?
Catherine rubbed the soreness out of her tit.
Would you mind turning around?
Of course.
Randy did a quick about-face.
What the fuck is going on?
Said Denise, coming out from the cabin.
It's cold as fuck, and I was just jolted out of my sleep by some kind of... Well, hello there, sugar tits. You best be careful. You like to poke someone's eyes out with them nip-nips.
Denise, said Randy,
have a little decency and turn around.
Denise raised a brow at Randy.
And what the fuck happened to you, homo erectus? You go one day without a cock in the ass, and now you're batting for the home team?
In under a minute, Catherine had heard as much of Denise as she wanted to for the day.
Turn the fuck around and shut your hairy-ass face, or I'll grab you by your fat red neck and throw you overboard.
Denise frowned.
It ain't right to judge folks based on stereotypes.
She turned around.
So what's going on here anyway? Y'all skinny dipping or something?
Just keep facing that way.
Catherine reached into the bag of holding.
All the water.
A gush of cold seawater fell out of the bag and onto her feet. She willed away the chill running up her legs and back and hoped her new theory was right.
My clothes,
she said, her hands still in the bag. She could feel right away that they were bone-ass dry.
It worked. I'm so fucking awesome.
Randy turned to her.
What did you... Oh, you're still naked.
He turned away quickly. Catherine hurriedly pulled her clothes back on, relishing the warmth of her own retained body heat, especially when she finally wrapped herself in that thick black cloak.
Okay, I'm decent now.
So what the fuck was that all about?
Asked Denise.
As it turns out, a bag of holding can also be used as a clothes dryer.
She thought about the rats.
Or a horrible way to kill a person.
I know exactly what you're talking about, said Randy. My cousin Ronnie got stuck in the dryer once when we was kids. Well, his mama turned it on, let it run a full minute to teach him a lesson about how dangerous it was.
Catherine gawked for a moment at Randy's latest demonstration of how fucked up his upbringing was, then reined in her thoughts again. That's not what I'm talking about at all. Randy frowned.
Yeah, now that I think about it, those particular dangers wouldn't necessarily apply to being inside a bag. So what's the big revelation?
Asked Denise. Catherine grinned. Right. So when I was floating around inside the bag of holding, I noticed that all the dead rats were shriveled up like furry prunes. Denise grimaced.
That sounds like an old man's nutsack.
Randy had a more concerned expression on his face.
What happened to him?
I asked myself the exact same question, said Catherine. And then it hit me.
A dead rat?
Asked Randy. No, the answer to my question. When everyone was fighting on the Maiden's Voyage, I blasted Captain Martinoli with water from the bag of holding. After pausing for whatever dumb hillbilly comments they might want to interrupt her with, she continued. I explicitly said all the water. Along with the seawater I'd collected, the bag ejected all the moisture from the rats' bodies. Randy offered an unconvincing grin.
Well, that's gross. How much water do you reckon that bag can hold?
Asked Denise, holding onto the railing with both hands and looking toward the front of the ship. Catherine appreciated hearing something from her that wasn't completely vile. I don't know, a lot. Why?
Because unless you can swallow up the whole goddamn ocean, your clothes is about to get wet again.
Catherine leaned over the railing and looked past Denise. Shit! They'd run into a sheet of ice and had torn a hole in the hull.
On the bright side, said Randy, this is what we've been looking for, ain't it?
Some bright side. Once we get the Eye of Rasha, how the fuck are we supposed to get back to the mainland? She sighed in frustration. Oh, I swear, I'm the worst captain in the history of... A cry like a yeti caught in a bear trap broke her train of thought. Denise peered into the darkness.
The fuck was that? Sounds like it's right on top of us.
The beast cried out again, sending a chill up Catherine's spine that had nothing to do with the cold.
No, said Randy. Right below us. It's Basil.
He and Catherine ran to the winch that lowered the cargo hatch and turned it together as fast as they could. The damage to the boat was worse than Catherine had first suspected. Water was gushing in, and poor Basil was up to his fat, leathery neck in it. He cried out again. If Catherine had to guess, she'd say this cry sounded more like relief than the first two had. Randy stepped carefully down the ramp into the water and guided the massive beast back up onto the deck. Catherine noticed that the water was deeper at the rear of the ship than it was at the front, which seemed odd considering that's where the hole was. Even as she watched, the water began to crystallize around the top of the breach. And while it was still flowing in at a much faster rate than they could ever hope to bail it out, it seemed to have slowed down a bit.
Hey!
Called Denise from up near the front of the ship.
Y'all come check this shit out!
Catherine glanced up at Randy, who also seemed doubtful as to whether or not he wanted to check out whatever it was Denise wanted to show them. She forced herself to remember that Denise was pregnant and that no matter how satisfying it might feel at first, she would probably ultimately come to regret throwing the bitch overboard. Seeing how low the rear of the ship had sunk in the water at this point, there wouldn't be any point in wasting the effort to throw anyone overboard anyway. She had to hold onto the railing to help herself climb her way up the incline to the front of the ship. When she got there, she saw that throwing Denise overboard would be pointless for a reason other than the one which had just occurred to her. Denise was already overboard.
Look at me,
said Denise, standing on solid ice.
I'm walking on water, just like Jesus.
She'd obviously climbed down the anchor chain, which was hanging from the front of the boat. The anchor itself didn't appear to have chipped the ice it lay on.
It doesn't make any sense, said Catherine. It's chilly out here, but it doesn't feel nearly cold enough to freeze water.
Especially seawater,
said Randy, still down at the rear of the ship with Basil.
On account of it being so salty.
Catherine gave him a thumbs up for saying something smart, then wondered if that might have come off as patronizing. But Randy beamed at the gesture.
Ain't no sense to be made of it, said Denise. We're at a semi-tropical latitude. The water don't freeze naturally around here, salty or otherwise. But this is obviously magical ice.
Catherine resisted the urge to tell her to go fuck herself. Go on.
Jesus, woman, don't you get it? The cold air ain't making the water freeze. It's all the goddamn ice that's making the air cold.
Oh. While what Denise was saying sounded reasonable, Catherine still had to suppress the urge to tell her to go fuck herself.
"Hang on a sec," said Randy.
He peeked down into the cargo hold. When he pulled his head back out, his face looked hopeful.
"It looks like the hole's froze over and plugged itself up with ice. The ship might not sink after all."
Catherine supposed that was sort of a silver lining, but a ship stuck in ice wasn't going to do her any more good than a ship stuck at the bottom of the ocean as far as getting back to the mainland went. She'd have to cross that bridge when she came to it. Right now, she had to focus on getting to the island proper and getting that stupid gem from that stupid ice bitch. Getting Basil down onto the ice was going to be a challenge. "Hey, Randy," she said as persuasively as she could. "How do you feel about leaving Basil here while the three of us go to the island?" Randy frowned.
"I don't know for sure that the ice is going to keep this ship afloat, and I'd hate to leave him out here alone. He might get scared."
"Oh, come on," said Catherine, trying to sound confident. "The ship's not going anywhere. We can leave him a couple of dehydrated rats to chew on. He'll never know we were gone." Dim as he was, she could tell he wasn't buying it. She could smell her own bullshit as she spoke the words. "Look, I just don't see how we're going to get him down there on the ice. He can't climb down the anchor chain, and he's too big to put in the bag of holding." Randy smiled.
"We just gotta get creative is all. We've solved harder problems than this before." "Y'all keep flapping your gums for another hour," said Denise from down on the ice. "I reckon the problem will just solve itself."
Catherine turned on her with a severe glare.
"Listen, fuckhead, I've had about enough of your shit. We're trying to come up with a solution to a problem, so if you've got nothing to contribute, I'd appreciate you shutting the fuck up."
Denise put her hands on her hips.
"And I just gave you a solution, Miss Potty Mouth. Give it an hour or so, and the problem will solve itself."
She sounded suspiciously unlike a sarcastic bitch.
"What are you talking about?"
"Take a look."
Denise gestured to where the front of the boat met the ice.
"It's still expanding, slowly but surely. At the rate it's going, I reckon the whole ship will be engulfed in ice in about an hour's time. When the ice reaches the rear of the ship, that fat-ass freak of nature can just step over the railing."
As the sun continued to rise, the ice continued to engulf the ship as Denise had predicted it would. When Catherine and Randy successfully guided Basil and Butterbean off the rear deck and onto the unnaturally solid ice, Catherine rewarded Denise's ingenuity by not punching her in her smug, hairy face. Across what looked like miles of solid ice, Catherine saw a small bump on the horizon. She and Randy hoisted Denise onto Basil's back, and they started the long, cold walk to the island of Nazir. Chapter 45. Chaz could sense they were headed in the right direction by the increasing gloominess of their surroundings. Perhaps right direction wasn't quite the correct way to put it. He was still torn between helping the pixies and just getting the hell out of this forest. He sensed, rather, that they were heading in their intended direction. Purple vines clung weakly to the trunks of dying trees, their wilted black petals falling like volcanic ash. The further they traveled, the more abundantly this ominous strain of flora dominated the terrain.
"This place is creeping me out," he said, barely above a whisper. "What kind of flowers are these?"
Cooper continued walking without responding, and Chaz assumed he was ignoring him, but after a moment passed, he spoke up.
"Nabi says they're called morning glories. When they're healthy, they're a beautiful shade of blue. The Dark Lord is sapping the life out of the forest. The nearer we get to him, the more evident his influence becomes."
Chaz plucked a black petal and rubbed it between his fingers. It produced a dark blue smudge.
"Well, we must be getting pretty close, because his influence is evident as fuck."
"You need to hurry,"
squawked an avian voice, flying in from behind them.
"Jesus, Ravenous,"
said Chaz. As much practice as he now had speaking in a phony British accent, it never felt any less douchey.
"You can't sneak up on people like that. You about gave me a heart attack."
Ravenous flew to a branch and spoke to Chaz as he passed under it.
"The goblins aren't far behind you. You'd do well to hide yourselves."
"Will you tell that bird to shut the fuck up?"
said Cooper.
"He says the goblins are right behind us."
"All the more reason for him to shut the fuck up. He sounds like a goddamn car alarm."
"Ask Nabi what we're supposed to do now."
Cooper walked in silence for a moment, then relayed Nabi's thoughts.
"It all boils down to, if we let him get in their defensive positions, we're fucked."
Chaz nodded eagerly.
Yes, that makes sense. What else?
They'll shoot us both dead before we even get near them, and they'll make sure they finish the job this time.
I understand that,
said Chaz.
All of that was implied by we're fucked, so at the risk of repeating myself, what are we supposed to do?
After another pause, Cooper said,
Not let them get in their defensive positions.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you, General MacArthur.
It became evident to Chaz that he was going to have to take some initiative in developing a strategy.
What have we got to work with? I have a goblin bow, and just marginally enough strength to fire it. You have a magical axe and barbarian rage. To best leverage our assets, we should find a spot they're certain to pass through, where I can hide up in a tree, and you can hide at the base of it.
It's nice how you leverage your ass, set up a tree, and leave me down here to fight off a dozen goblins by myself.
I'm your air support, firing arrows from above. You're the tank. These are our respective roles, and unless you can think of anything better, the best chance I see of us taking these assholes out.
What about my idea of grabbing them one at a time while they're taking the shit?
Chaz didn't want to tell him directly how shitty a plan that was, but their time was running out. Fortunately, while he was trying to think of a more roundabout way of saying the same thing, Cooper spoke up again.
Nabi likes your plan better,
he said glumly.
Some friend.
Don't take it like that,
said Chaz, seeing an opportunity to win Cooper over a little, which couldn't hurt when he was depending on Cooper to keep him alive.
She only wants what's best for you. Rather than spare your feelings, she made a decision against your objectively shitty plan.
Shit. Wasn't I just trying to avoid saying that exact thing?
Fuck your mother.
Chaz didn't feel any more comforted about Cooper's desire to keep him alive.
I'm just saying that she cares about you. She wants to make sure you have the best possible chance of getting out of this alive, and she's willing to tell you things you don't want to hear in order to make sure that happens. Isn't that what true friendship is all about?
Cooper shrugged, which was better than a punch in the face.
I guess so. That's kind of what happened between me and Tim one time. I told him some shit I thought he didn't want to hear, but I thought he needed to.
Chaz let out a silent sigh of relief. They were getting somewhere, perhaps even bonding.
Good for you. How'd that work out?
He fell way off the deep end, slit Mordred's throat, and then wound up getting himself murdered, so not well.
Oh,
said Chaz.
I'm sorry. I assumed you were referring to a time further back in your relationship.
You know, your plan is pretty shitty, too. I mean, where the fuck am I supposed to hide at the base of a fucking tree?
Chaz considered the trees and determined that Cooper had made a good point. Some were thicker than others, but none were even close to thick enough for a big-ass half-orc barbarian to reliably hide behind. The plan was heavily dependent on the element of surprise. If the goblins got a chance to organize from any appreciable distance, Cooper would be shot down before he could get a swing in. So absorbed was he in trying to think up a solution to this problem that he tripped over the obvious solution and fell face first into more of it. He rolled onto his back and grinned up at Cooper.
Vines!
Really fucking observant of you. I'm glad you're on my side.
No, I mean, the ground is literally covered in vines.
Cooper furrowed his brow, then his eyes widened.
Do you have an entangle spell?
No, and I can't cast any spells right now anyway without an instrument.
Then who gives a shit about the vines?
You can hide under them. We'll rip a bunch of vines out of the ground and cover you with them at the base of a tree. You'll look like a small hill or a mound.
After silently consulting his axe, Cooper sighed.
Ugh, now B thinks it could work.
In the couple of days since the shadow monsters had drained his strength, Chaz felt like he'd regained some of it. Standing upright no longer felt like a workout, and his arms didn't feel like they were made out of lead when he lifted them. But uprooting these morning glory vines was really a chore. After freeing one from its hold in the rich earth, he wiped the sweat from his brow and checked on Cooper, who had ripped out enough vines to cover 10 of himself.
They're coming!
Ravenous whispered urgently, flapping down to land on a branch near Chaz's head.
Yeah, we know. You already...
Chaz shut up when he heard the terrible, randomly blown notes of someone who obviously didn't have a whole lot of practice playing satyr pipes.
Holy shit, they're coming!
He looked for a suitable tree in the path of where the music was coming from. Finally, a spot of luck. The perfect tree stood out like a gift from the gods. It had a low branch leading to a slightly higher one, then to an even higher branch with enough leaves and morning glory vines to provide a decent amount of cover. From that position, Chaz thought he might be able to fire off 3 or 4 arrows before the goblins discovered where he was shooting from. That would be more than enough time for the fight to have been pretty well decided.
"There!"
he said to Cooper, pointing at his selected tree.
"Hurry up! They're practically here!"
Cooper dropped his massive pile of vines on the ground next to the tree. He laid Nabi down on the opposite side to where the terrible music was coming from, then picked up the vines and dumped them on the axe. Finally, he crawled under the vine pile to join Nabi. Chaz stood back and tried to imagine seeing this as a natural scene. He couldn't do it. It was obviously a pile of vines someone had deliberately put at the base of a tree. It would definitely arouse suspicion. He smoothed down the sides of the pile, pulling some of the vines around to the front of the tree. Standing back a second time, he felt better about how it looked. It wouldn't pass a close inspection, but by the time the goblins got close enough to make that distinction, it would be too late. The music was getting closer. Chaz hurried back to the tree and jumped up to catch the lowest branch. There, hanging like a dumbass with death marching toward him, he discovered the fatal flaw in his plan. He'd regained some of his strength back, but nowhere close to all of it. Certainly not enough to do a pull-up. Hell, in this body, he wasn't sure if he could do a pull-up at full strength. He glanced down at the mound of vines by his dangling feet and considered asking Cooper to give him a boost, but Cooper couldn't be trusted to properly hide himself alone. Shit, shit, shit. Think, think, think. No, there's no time. Fuck it. Chaz let go of the branch, dropped to a lying position on the ground, and slithered into the vine pile.
"Dude,"
said Cooper.
"What the fuck? You're supposed to be up in the tree."
Chaz readied his goblin bow and laid a few arrows from the quiver on the ground next to him.
"I'm too weak to climb."
He sniffed the air. There was something in it more pungent than vegetation or earth, like a dead skunk, or...
"Did you fart?"
"Yes."
"Jesus, dude."
Chaz's eyes were watering.
"How can you stand that?"
"Fuck you. I wasn't expecting company."
"Could you stop moving around so much? You're making it..."
"Hey!"
cried Ravenous as loud as he possibly could. What the hell was he thinking? Did he not understand what their situation was? Chaz wanted to tell him to shut up, but there were limits to how far he'd stick his neck out for a bird.
"Hey, you goblins! I'm up here in the tree!"
The amateur pipe music stopped playing, and the goblins began chattering among themselves. Chaz couldn't understand the goblin tongue, but he thought he had a pretty good idea of what they were probably saying.
"Did you hear that? It sounds like a bird. How could that be? The Dark Ones cleared this place out. It could have flown in from somewhere else. Who cares? It sounds like a big fucker. Let's shoot it." "Dibs on a leg." "Fuck off. You ate both legs last time. You'll be lucky to get the neck."
"You know what I like? Cornish hens."
"Oh, yes. Those are lovely."
Chaz was making up random shit at this point. He had no idea what the goblins were going on about and why it was taking them so long to act. He was worried that they might have spotted him and Cooper, then felt relieved when he heard bowstrings twanging, but didn't feel arrows boring holes in his face.
"Shit!"
cried Ravenous. The goblins shouted short imperatives at each other. They were circling in.
"You missed me!"
Ravenous taunted them, but his tone was less cocky than his words. He was purposely trying to draw them in closer.
"Any time, you gentlemen, already!"
"That's our cue!"
whispered Chaz.
"Let me get one shot off before you start roiding out and tearing shit up."
He grabbed an arrow and brushed some vine out of his face to find a target. The first goblin he saw didn't have his bow out. He had something in his hands, but Chaz couldn't make out exactly what it was. With the odds against them as much as they already were, he sought to maximize whatever opportunities he could. An already armed goblin would make a better target. Success would mean 2 less arrows being fired back at them rather than only the one from the goblin who was currently unprepared. He brushed away a little more vine to improve his view and spotted a goblin aiming his bow high toward the upper branches of the tree. Perfect. Then a movement in his periphery drew his attention back to the unarmed goblin. It brought whatever was in its hands to its mouth, then started playing familiarly terrible music.
"That son of a..."
Chaz said before he could stop himself. The goblin's eyes locked with his, and it blew a sharp, loud note which was even more off-key than its usual performance. Their cover blown, Chaz didn't bother with trying to be sneaky while knocking his arrow.
"Now, Cooper!"
he cried and released his bowstring. The goblin, who had dropped Zanzifrol's pipes and was frantically grabbing for his own bow, caught Chaz's arrow in the gut. His groan of agony was more pleasing to the ear than any note he'd blown on those pipes.
"I'm really angry,"
said Cooper, rising out of the vine pile amid confused goblin shrieks and cries. Cooper in his barbarian rage looked terrifying enough without any additional accoutrement, but the creepy black vines hanging from his body must have had the goblins shitting themselves. He looked like some kind of swamp revenant returned from the dead to exact revenge upon those who had slain him. He ran at the goblin Chaz had shot and grabbed it by the neck, he and Nabi both apparently trying to resist the urge to just chop it in half. If it was still alive at this point, the two arrows it intercepted as they were on their way to Cooper surely did it in. No longer having any use for it, Cooper threw the dead goblin at one of its companions, but hit the tree it was taking cover behind instead. Arrows were flying past Cooper from multiple directions, but only three managed to hit him. Chaz couldn't see where all of the arrows were coming from. Having been caught unaware and unprepared, the goblins weren't fighting as an organized unit. They were more concerned about individual survival than they were about their blitzkrieg battle tactics. If Cooper and Chaz could keep the chaos going, they would have a fighting chance. He spotted one goblin who was still scrambling to find cover. An arrow in its ass didn't kill it, but it got its attention. The twang of bowstrings seemed to be lessening, but it was difficult to make out such specific sounds over the din of Cooper's rage-induced fit of swearing and goblin screams cut short by crunches and splatters. Chaz sought out another target and spotted a goblin peeking up from behind their pile of equipment. He took aim, then...
"Yah!"
he cried at a sudden searing pain in his lower back. Chaz had been shot enough times now to know the feel of an arrow, but it never got any easier. Pulling them out was hard enough when they were in easy-to-reach places. The pain would be that much worse trying to grab it at such an awkward angle. He forced himself to think of all the filthy little goblin hands that had touched the arrow. They probably wiped their asses with those hands, and they almost certainly didn't wash with soap afterward. That was just the motivation he needed to reach around back, grit his teeth, and give the arrow a nice, hard yank. He sighed. Fuck, that hurt. Thwunk, thwunk. Two more arrow shafts wobbled in the trunk of the tree right next to his head. Why were they shooting at him? Wasn't Cooper still a more threatening? Shit, Cooper, was he...
"Fuck you, and you, and you!"
Cooper's voice conveyed the exertion of axe chops. Evidently, he was still alive. Chaz crawled around the tree for cover and saw that, while Cooper had about a dozen arrows poking out of him, he was still up and fighting. The goblins who were shooting at Chaz must have been doing so because he was an easier target for them to aim for without moving from their hiding places. Cooper was doing as good a job as could be expected, but he wouldn't be able to hold out much longer. Chaz needed to help more effectively if they were going to get out of this alive.
"Chaz!"
cried a tiny, high-pitched female voice.
"Templethorn!"
Chaz looked in the direction he thought the voice had come from, over by the goblin's equipment. Of course! The goblins had brought the goddamn cavalry with them. Inside the little rickshaw they'd been hauling their supplies in, Chaz spotted a moving blob of net peeking over the edge.
"Shut up!"
said the goblin, who was hiding behind the rickshaw. He swatted down on the net, eliciting a cry of pain from several of the trapped pixies and igniting a spark of fury in Chaz. He couldn't tolerate seeing someone hit such a delicate and beautiful creature, and he told himself it had nothing to do with her having given him a hand job.
"You goblin pieces of shit!"
he cried as he started running clumsily at the cart. His strength had not fully replenished. His legs weren't quite ready for a sprint. He must have looked like a drunken asshole because the goblin he was running at actually laughed as he knocked the arrow that might very well end Chaz's life. But while his strength may still be suffering, his charisma and dexterity scores were doing fine. He took advantage of them by using the bluff and tumble skills to feign moving left, then rolled to the right and picked up Zanzifrol's pipes. The feigning left worked well enough, causing the goblin to fire in the wrong direction. The roll, on the other hand, turned out to be more of just a run-of-the-mill falling to the ground, grabbing the pipes, and standing back up. Not a whole lot of panache, but it got the job done. By the time the goblin had another arrow ready, Chaz was on top of it, tackling it with a similar grace he'd demonstrated with his tumble attempt. Even though he was twice its size, Chaz guessed that they were about equally matched in strength. The goblin might have actually been 1 or 2 points stronger than him. If he lost his current advantage, he would be highly unlikely to regain it, so he sought to maintain it the best way he could think of, by throttling the goblin's throat with both hands and repeatedly slamming its disproportionately large head against the ground. He considered what Nabi had requested about trying to keep some of the goblins alive, but this felt like a kill-or-be-killed situation, and he was going to put everything he had into not ending this fight on the be-killed side. The goblin's yellow neck skin felt dry and leathery, like an old woman's tit. Its tiny red eyes bulged as it tried to scream, but only squeaked out a weak groan. Chaz squeezed harder until even that was cut off. He started to tire, and he wondered how long it actually took to strangle someone to death. It normally went a lot faster in movies. Finally, after enough time had passed such that the act of murder was actually getting boring, the goblin stopped resisting. Its arms went limp and fell to its sides. Chaz slammed its head against the ground a few more times to make sure. When he was satisfied that his goblin adversary was sufficiently dead, he peeked over the cart for any impending attacks. Cooper and Nabi didn't appear to care too much about keeping goblin survivors. They were employing all the restraint of someone binging on a party-sized bag of Doritos on cheat day. Goblin body parts were strewn around the forest floor. Dripping bits of gore hung from branches like Christmas tree tinsel. Some poor bastard's intestines were dragging behind Cooper's right foot like a strand of toilet paper as he chased some other poor bastard whose intestines were about to meet a similar fate.
"Chaz," said Dimplethorn. "Let us out of here."
Chaz examined the net. Individual ropes looped around a cord running around the rim like a drawstring bag. The drawstring cord ran through a hole in the side of the cart, down to a hook on the bottom where it was tied off. This was obviously a precautionary measure to avoid allowing captured prisoners to release themselves. As soon as he untied the cord, the opening of the net expanded quickly, then the whole structure collapsed as if it had been a living net monster that suffered a sudden and fatal heart attack. The next thing Chaz knew, about a dozen stray arrows rose from the ground and hovered in the air, pointing one way and then another, looking for a target. Unfortunately for them, it appeared that Cooper and Nabi had deprived them of their opportunity for vengeance. Cooper's barbarian rage finally tapped out, flowing out of his ass in a long extended fart as he leaned against a tree, sweating profusely. He looked like shit, bleeding from a multitude of arrow wounds. Chaz hadn't bothered to count, but Cooper might have had more arrows in him now than he'd had in the pool of true sight. He couldn't possibly have more than a couple of hit points left. The group of floating arrows moved simultaneously away from Cooper's fart cloud, drawing his attention.
"What the fuck?"
Some movement in the bushes from the other direction caught Chaz's eye. Two more goblins stood and took aim at Cooper's back.
"Cooper!"
cried Chaz.
"What?"
Cooper snapped back, annoyed. Thwang, thwang. The first arrow lodged in Cooper's right ass cheek, but the second one went in one side of his neck and out the other. Cooper's eyes widened and glazed over as arterial blood gushed out of his neck.
"Bear!"
cried Dimplethorn. All the arrows swarmed at the two goblins who hadn't noticed them until now. One of the goblins said something that Chaz could only assume translated to "holy fucking shit," and started running away while the other one fired an arrow harmlessly through the swarm of arrows descending on them. The flock of angry pixies hacked at the goblin who'd fired the arrow like it was the Ides of March. They splattered so much goblin blood on each other that Chaz could make out some of their forms. Their bloodlust, not quite sated, they flew after the goblin who wisely, albeit lately, decided to run.
"Try to take that one alive!"
Chaz yelled after them as he ran to Cooper. He was no doctor, but Cooper looked as dead as any of the goblins whose entrails were currently decorating the forest. After snapping the fletching off the back of the arrow in Cooper's neck, he pulled the shaft out through the other side, causing blood to flow out more quickly. "Shit, I made it worse. Come on, Chaz, we're so close. Think of something."
"Come on, Cooper."
Chaz wiped unexpected tears from his eyes.
"Don't you die on me, you crazy fuck."
"Is he okay?"
said Ravenous, hopping to Cooper's head and giving it a poke with his beak.
"Does he look fucking okay to you?"
"He looks dead to me. Mind you, that's an amateur opinion. I thought you were both dead only yesterday."
Knowing he was going to regret it, he asked,
What should I do? And I swear to God, if you say anything about eating his fucking eyes, I'll roast you over a fire.
You needn't be rude, said Ravenous. I've seen you use magic before. Have you any spells which might be useful under these circumstances? The fat one with the hair growing out of his face sometimes uses magic to heal wounds.
Dave? He's a cleric. I'm a bard.
A bird?
No, dipshit. You're a fucking bird. I'm a bard.
What's a bard?
I sing and play musical instruments and shit.
Ravenous cocked his head to the side, blinking up at Chaz.
That doesn't seem like a particularly useful skill set.
It makes magic happen. You saw me make an acorn glow. I can use it to charm people or put them to sleep or... Actually, I don't even know what else I can do with it. I can't remember the last time I checked my spells. Keep an eye on them for a second and try not to let them die.
And just how am I supposed to?
Chaz ignored Ravenous's bitching as he sat in as comfortable a position as he could manage, closed his eyes, and brought Zanzifrel's pipes to his lips. He blew a soft melody and focused on that, tuning out everything else in an effort to clear his mind. In the clarity of his meditation, he was able to observe the power of his music. He couldn't see or hear it exactly. It was as if he could feel it on some super-conscious level and understand how he might manipulate notes and lyrics to produce real and tangible effects. One such effect, he was surprised to discover, was the ability to cure moderate wounds. He was so excited at having discovered it that he nearly lost it. Forcing himself to calm down, he concentrated on understanding how the spell worked until he felt it become part of him. He opened his eyes and looked at Ravenous.
I know what to do.
Like any of the spells he'd come to understand, cure moderate wounds simply required an appropriate song. The only one that came to mind off the top of his head was Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing, but he didn't feel comfortable singing that while touching Cooper. Touching, unfortunately, was a necessary part of casting the spell. It was also kind of a logistical problem, as Chaz needed both hands to play the pipes properly. At least that issue was easily enough solved. Chaz removed his shoe and placed the sole of his bare foot on Cooper's face. Ravenous eyed him curiously.
I feel it would be remiss of me to not suggest that what you're doing right now might not be very helpful.
Shut up. I'm trying to think of a song.
Chaz blew a few notes into the pipes and figured he'd start the lyrics simply and see where it went from there.
Cure moderate wounds,
he sang, then tried to think of something that rhymed with wounds.
Hear my moderate tunes.
Cooper coughed weakly, and Chaz could see that blood was no longer flowing from the hole in his neck. Holy shit, it's actually working. Not wanting to lose his momentum, he quickly thought up some more words for the song.
If you're ever harpooned.
Now he needed something good to bring it home full circle.
Cure moderate wounds.
What the fuck are you singing?
Said Cooper.
Why's your foot in my face?
He still looked like shit. The song could obviously use a little refining, but at least he was unquestionably alive. Chaz removed his foot from Cooper's face and put his shoe back on.
I just saved your life. I can cast Cure Moderate Wounds now.
Cooper winced as he sat up.
Hang on. Did you just level up by watching me kill all those goblins?
No,
said Chaz indignantly.
I actually killed one of them myself, and I assisted on two others. As for the spell, I don't know how long I've been able to cast it. I keep forgetting to update myself when I level up.
Dude, you're already useless enough as a bard. Not using what few powers you have is like you're training for the Uselessness Olympics.
You know what? I'm getting a little tired of being...
Wah!
Cried a goblin, inexplicably flying toward them like a short, big-headed, terrified Superman. Its cry stopped abruptly when its flight turned into an 8-foot free fall, and it landed hard on the ground in front of Chaz and Cooper.
Alive, just as you requested,
said Dimplethorn.
Please let us know if you change your mind.
The goblin sat up. Its eyes were dark and puffy. It was bleeding from both nostrils, and a few of its teeth appeared to be freshly missing. Dimplethorn and the others may have spared the poor creature's life, but not without beating the shit out of it first. Chaz could scarcely believe that those same tiny hands, which had so delicately caressed his dick, were capable of this kind of ferocity.
Hey, shitbag,
said Cooper.
Do you speak English?
The goblin's eyes darted back and forth like he was considering making another run for it, but focused on Cooper when he picked up Nabi.
What?